Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Good morning, and kicking off our day long, and the theme of the day is ahara or nutriment. This is something that was requested. And just to start off with a little story, everybody know Anattapindika? Have you heard the name before? Was a very famous householder in the time of the Buddha, a very famous benefactor of the Buddha and the Sangha. His name means one who gives to those who have little or those who have not. So he was literally known for generosity. It became like the name that everybody gave him. And he spent his entire life giving and delighting in giving. And because of that, he got to be very friendly with a lot of important Buddhist figures, the Buddha, and he had a special faith in Venerable Sariputta. And it turns out that when Anattapindika was dying, he was on his deathbed, it was requested that Venerable Sariputta come and give a talk, and Venerable Ananda accompanied Venerable Sariputta. And they went to the bedside of Anattapindika, and Venerable Sariputta gave a stirring, rousing Dhamma talk on profound teachings. He said, "Don't grasp at the eye, and don't let your consciousness arise dependent on it. Don't grasp at the ear, don't grasp at the nose," and on and on and on. This is how you should train yourself. Don't let your consciousness arise dependent on any of these things. Let them go. And as Venerable Sariputta is giving this Dhamma talk, Anattapindika starts to cry. And Ananda, who was a very, very soft, very empathetic guy, he's like, "Oh, householder, you're crying. Is this too much? Is this too intense for you?" And Anattapindika is like, "Look, I'm not crying because I'm overwhelmed. I'm crying because for so many years, so many decades, I have drawn close to the Sangha and given to the Sangha and heard Dhamma talks, and yet I have never heard a Dhamma talk like this." And Ananda's like, "Oh, well, Dhamma talks like this, these intense kind of training Dhamma talks, they don't usually land with lay people. They're usually given to the monks." And Anattapindika is like, "Oh, they should be for everybody. There are people who have little dust in their eyes and yet are wasting away for lack of hearing Dhamma talks like this. So please, out of compassion, give such talks to householders." So I tell that story to say that because Anattapindika was such a nice guy, and because he asked so nicely, and because Laura asked so nicely, we can talk about ahara today, though it is a subject which is not really the kind of thing that you Dhamma talk on for lay people, because it requires to understand it completely that you be a non-returner or on the path of non-returning, or an arahant or on the path of arahantship. It requires that you think of consciousness in an objective way. You're looking at consciousness like a scientist, and you're saying, "Why is it that beings arise? Why is it that consciousness arises? Why is it that samsara arises? Dependent on what do these things arise? And with the absence of what do they not arise?" This is kind of different from like figuring out what you're going to have for dinner, right? This is not terribly relevant to a lot of things that are really important in cultivating Buddhist practice, like dana and metta and sila, giving, precepts, loving kindness. These things are really relevant and have immediate results in your daily life. But sitting around thinking about nutriment, you might get it intellectually, and it might encourage you to look further, and that's probably the best we can hope for, because to have an experiential understanding of it, you have to get the mind to a place beyond this nutriment, this concept, which may take some time. It may yet be in the future. But it's not the Buddha's fault. It's not, sorry, Buddha's fault. It's not Anatta Pindika's fault. It is the Dhamma's fault. The Dhamma is intriguing. It is ahipasiko. It snares us. We hear there are these four nutriments and we're like, ooh, we want to know more. And so today we'll investigate a little bit into these four nutriments and what are they and what does it mean? And that's my disclaimer. If it doesn't make sense, set it aside. We'll practice some metta. If it seems too intense, and especially the sutta we cover in the afternoon, it will be framed in unabashedly in it's a sutta for monastics. It is a sutta for people who are serious about attaining the fruits of enlightenment in this very life. If it seems like, well, I don't really know how to use this, then just don't. Okay, but all that said, let's take a look at nutriment. Probably the first thing to say before we get into a sutta is to know how nutriment is framed in the Pali language and in the philosophy at the time of the Buddha is a little bit different than we might think. So we hear food, we hear nutriment, and we think, I get an apple, I eat an apple, I swallow it, I digest it, I assimilate the nutrients, and then I excrete it. Again, this is the normal worldly way of thinking about food. And thinking about the relationship to food, like there are beings and there is food and the beings go and get the food, like little amoebas, and they go, and they swallow it. And then there's waste product that they didn't swallow. There's also this idea that somewhere in that process, the food becomes the being, right? You eat the apple and at some point the apple is you. And we could study it with a microscope, but we can't really actually tell when that point is or if there is a point. And this is one of the philosophical traps that if you really got contemplating, you would get confused and would get nowhere, right? When does the food become the person? The problem is the whole idea. That framework of food talks about beings, and it talks about food as separate from the beings. That's not how the Buddha is using this word. Probably a better way to understand nutriment is like the way that in the time of the Buddha, they had a really tangible way of thinking about fire. The idea, the fire element, when there is fire, they believe that the fire was attached to its fuel source. You need to have the fuel to have the fire. The fire arises, but it can't leave its fuel source. It's dependent on that fuel source, but it's consuming the fuel source, obviously. But when the fuel source is depleted, the fire goes out. You know, it was dependent on that fuel source. It was attached to it out of necessity, right? And this is how they think of the fire element and how they think about digestion. They think of the body as like a flame. It is dependent on its fuel sources and is consuming them. And that when these fuel sources are expended, when they're out, then the flame goes out. The body goes out. The body dies. Yeah, the body is dependent on its fuel sources. Another way to think of nutriment might be a petri dish, right? You'll have an empty little glass dish and some bacteria float in on the air and they land on it. They land on there and they survive only as long as their lifespan dictates. They cannot grow, they cannot multiply, they can't really do much of anything because it's just glass. But if you were to take that petri dish and you were to smear some sugary nutrient substance on it, then when those bacteria land, they consume it. And the consuming it, they grow and they multiply and they spread. And suddenly you've got this big foaming bacterial colony ready to, we'll call it penicillin. We'll say it's ready to cure cancer or something. But realistically, it's just ready to make you sick. And so that's how we're talking about nutriment. Yeah. It is really independent of beings, but it is a fuel source. Yeah. And when beings arise, they are arising dependent on that fuel source, attached to it, drawn to it in a way. And this is nutriment. Yeah. Another way we might have a simile, and one that's very close to home, that'll make sense to Jim and Laura and Michaela. So Jim has a table in his kitchen, a nice sturdy wooden table from a bygone era when, it's like real wood. Yeah. And say this at this table, sometimes Jim, it's dinner time, yeah, it's lunchtime, it's breakfast time, and Jim sits at this table. When he sits at this table, because it is mealtime and because he is hungry, he has food. Now, normally, say an ant walking across that table, it happens once an hour, once every couple hours, once a day. An ant will walk across the table, it'll kind of do some loops, and not finding anything, it will wander on. It's not that there are no ants. I'm sorry, Jim, this is just a fact of reality. They're there. You're not doing anything wrong, but they don't stay. They don't grow, they don't multiply, they don't gather, they just wander through, and that's it. But because sometimes there is food, maybe Jim leaves some crumbs and goes on his way. Now, because there are crumbs, when an ant wanders by, it finds the crumbs, and then it becomes attached to, dependent on this food source. It's like, oh, wait, this is a place where I can live, this is a place where I can grow, this is a place where I can multiply. And they eat their fill, and then they go back to the colony, and then they come and they bring friends, and suddenly there's more ants. And then they go back to the colony, they bring their friends, so there's more ants and more ants, and suddenly you have all sorts of ants roaming around the table. And even if one were to clean up the table, the ants would keep coming back for a while because of the previous presence of that food source. And now a spider happens along. And spiders happen along an hour, every hour, every couple hours, every couple days, a spider walks across the table. I'll get to you, Satine, don't worry. And they wander through, but they don't find anything. But now, because the ants have drawn to the crumbs, the spider lingers. They wait and they watch because now there is food, right? And every now and then, an ant wanders too close to the spider and is, it grabs it, it sucks it dry like a little Capri Sun, and then it tosses it off the table. Yeah. And it waits for another one to wander by. And it grabs it, drains it like a juice box, throws it away. And it hangs out dependent on this fuel source, right? Dependent on this food. And we would think, food, those are living beings. Yeah. But to the spider, they're just food. Right. And now, Satine is the cat, Jim's cat, doesn't want for food. Jim is well trained and he provides food at multiple opportunities during the day. And Satine doesn't even eat it all, right? Sometimes there's little bits left for her to come back and nibble on from time to time. And but drawn to the movement on the table. She gets up on the table, and as she's watching, she sees the ants and they're moving. And then she sees spiders and they're moving. And so, fascinated with the movement, she hangs out on the table. And every now and then, her desire just wells up and thunk, she lands her paw on one of the ants or one of the spiders and does what cats do, tortures and maims and mutilates the living creature for fun. Yeah, all of this because of the presence of food, ahara. Yeah, but you see how these things, they happen independently on their own without the food, but they do not stay, they do not grow, they do not multiply. But with the presence of food, these things stay, they grow, and they multiply. And now this is a simile The Buddha is not, he's not talking about food and ants when he describes this in mental training and in consciousness. He is describing a mental process. So the reason we can't really think about food necessarily in terms of ahara is because the mind cannot eat. The mind cannot swallow, it cannot digest, it cannot assimilate. The mind has no form. This is something that only form can do. Only bodies can swallow other bodies and digest them and assimilate them. Yeah. So how does the mind deal with nutriment? Well, the way that mind deals with nutriment is the mind becomes drawn to through craving. It becomes attached to through what we call upadana or dependency. And it becomes. It begins to linger at and identify with and stay in a position. It becomes established, as we say, based on nutriment. It doesn't have to. But the thing with our mind is there are some mental states, and we would usually put these in the category of either wholesome mental states or neutral mental states, which are like the ant just wandering through, or the spider just wandering through, or Satine the cat just wandering through. They arise, they just wander through, and then they go on their way. Yeah, they don't get established because there's nothing to get established on. It's not that they don't arise, but you don't get more of them. But then some mental states are not like that. Fueled by ignorance, fueled by desire, they are drawn towards nutriment, they gather around it, they become dependent on it, and then they multiply. So greed is like this, right? This is something attractive and we're drawn to it. We gather around it, we elaborate on it, and we keep coming back to it over and over again. It's not that we can stay with it forever. But once we find out there's this nice, tasty, pleasant object, we keep circling back to it over and over again, sometimes for the rest of our life. Even when that thing is not entirely pleasant, we keep circling back because it was once. Maybe this will be the time when it's just really, really good and we finally get satisfied. Doesn't happen, and we keep circling back, but that's the nature of the mind. Yeah, it doesn't have to do it, but because these mental states are based around the idea of a being, they look to get established, they look to grow, they look to multiply, and these mental states do. And so in mental training, if we step aside from consciousness, we step aside from craving, we step aside from beings and ignorance, and we see them as an observer. And we ask the question, dependent on what does consciousness arise? Yeah. Then we start to, then this idea of nutriment starts to make sense. It's like wherever we see a lot of craving and attachment and identification arising, there will be a fuel source. This is why the Buddha compared unwholesome states to fire. They gather and they are dependent on a fuel source. Yeah. Otherwise, there'd just be one every now and then. And that's if you only had an unwholesome mental state once every now and then, once an hour, once every couple of hours, once every couple of days, this path would not make sense. It just wouldn't be worth all the effort to get rid of a couple of wandering mental states. But because they tend to gather, it really pays to kind of look at what they gather around. What is their fuel source? What is their nutriment? What feeds them? What makes them grow? What makes them reproduce? Because by attending to that, you can deal with multiple problems at the same time. And this is the sort of thing you do for fun when you're practicing in a very intense way, like monastics or like lay hermits tend to do. When you're spending a lot of time at this, you stop thinking, what is me? What do I want? And you start thinking, what is consciousness? Why does it keep happening? So let's look at a sutta, and that it might also frame why this is why it's a problem. Yeah. So this, let's see, this sutta. All right, so this is Samyutta Nikaya 12, the Book of Causation, number 64. And everybody can see it? Yeah, see it? Okay. So it says, if there is desire, Atsavati, this is the Buddha speaking, monks, there are these four nutriments. They maintain sentient beings that have been born and help those that are about to be born. What for? Solid food, whether solid or subtle, or whether coarse or subtle. Contact, this is contact with the sense bases, is the second. Mental intention is the third, and consciousness is the fourth. These are the four nutriments that maintain sentient beings that have been born and help those that are about to be born. If there is desire, relishing and craving for solid food, consciousness becomes established there and grows. Where consciousness is established and grows, name and form are conceived. When name and form are conceived, there is the growth of sankharas, mental fabrications, choices. Where sankharas grow, there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. When there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future, there is rebirth, old age, and death in the future. Where there is rebirth, old age, and death in the future, I say this is full of sorrow, anguish, and distress. Now, if there is desire, relishing, and craving for contact, if there is desire, relishing, and craving for mental intention, if there's desire, relishing, and craving for consciousness as fuel, then consciousness will become established there and grow. Where consciousness is established and grows, name and form are conceived, or name and form are conceived, there are sankharas. And when sankharas grow, there is the rebirth into a new state of existence. Where there's rebirth, old age, death in the future, I say this is full of sorrow, anguish, and distress. Suppose an artist or a painter had some dye, red lac, turmeric, indigo, or rose madder. And on a polished plank or a wall or a canvas, they'd create the form of a woman or a man, whole in its major and minor limbs. In the same way, if there is desire, relishing, and craving for solid food, consciousness will become established there and grow. And where consciousness is established and grows, so on and so on, there is rebirth, old age, and death. I say, this is full of sorrow, anguish, and distress. On with the other for nutrients. Then he says, suppose there was a bungalow or a hall with a peaked roof with windows on the north, south, or eastern side. When the sun rises and a ray of light enters through a window, where would it land? Well, it would land on the western wall, sir. Well, if there was no western wall, where would it land? It would land on the ground, sir. But if there was no ground, where would it land? And here, in the Indian cosmology, they believe that all of the land, all the earth, sits on top of water. And with modern science, we know this to be true. There is groundwater, so technically, all of that we're sitting on has water underneath it. If there was no land, then the light would land on water. But if there was no water, where would the light land? And they say, well, it wouldn't land anywhere, sir. In the same way, if there is no desire, relishing, and craving for solid food, then consciousness does not become established there and doesn't grow. If there's no desire, relishing, and craving for contact, for mental intention, or for consciousness, then consciousness doesn't become established there and grow. Then when consciousness is not established and doesn't grow, name and form are not conceived. When name and form are not conceived, there is no growth of sankharas. When sankharas don't grow, there is no rebirth into a new state of existence. When there's no rebirth into a new state of existence, there is no rebirth, old age, and death in the future. When there is no rebirth, old age, and death in the future, I say there's no sorrow, anguish, and distress. This is what the Buddha said. Okay. So get to it. So you say, so how do we apply this? Well, what we're going to do this morning is we're just going to try to figure out what these four nutriments are. Yeah. And then wholly at your own interest and volition, you can start to explore how this might be applied, how this might be relevant, where you might look to, well, maybe do something about this. But again, it could only work if you were to see this as outside yourself. You were to say, well, there are these consciousnesses that cause me suffering. Yeah, consciousnesses of greed, of lust, of attachment, consciousnesses of anger, of indignation, of rage, consciousnesses of confusion, delusion, ego, conceit. All of these consciousnesses, I would really be okay if they withered away and died. You know, if I could lock them in a closet and just wait until they stopped pounding on the door and fell silent, then I would do that with absolute viciousness. I would attend to these, because this is the way that monks think. Yeah. We're not like, oh, but they're my consciousnesses, and I want to accept them and nurture them and protect them. You know, as the Thai forest master Ajahn Dunn would say, you're trying to kill yourself, trying to kill the self. Yeah, you're seeing your ego as a problem. It's where your suffering comes from. It is hurting you. If you do find yourself in a kind of mind state where it's like, wow, you know, this thing that keeps making me suffer, I really don't want it anymore. Take away its food. Figure out what it's eating and take away the food. You may find that, just like Satine the cat, it's there because you keep putting out a bowl of food every morning. If you stop doing that, its loyalty would wane very quickly. You know, Jim, you and Satine have a good thing going. You're probably not going to stop feeding her. And if you did, she would probably be pretty confused, and she'd probably give you a couple of hours to consider your mistake. But she's a cat. And I don't think she would wait very much longer. I know, because we have cats here at the monastery, and there was the monk who feeds them was away. And I became the one who fed them. And the very first morning that he was away, I fed them, but they were looking for the other monk. So even though I put the food out, they didn't see the other monk come and put the food out. And they went on a rampage around the monastery, looking for him and looking for the food and trying to figure out what had gone. It took about an hour. And they had decided that everything that had happened before was no longer relevant, and a new order had to be established. A new servant had to be found. So you may find this. You may find that you take away the food source of a particular source of your suffering, and it begins to thrash and it begins to look for new food sources. But lock it in the closet, and let it waste away. Separated from its food source, and it will eventually leave. Yeah. Okay. So, what are these four nutrients? I cannot claim to truly deeply understand these four nutrients. That would be very conceited of me. I can only claim to have thought about them for a while. And so this is what I suggest you do as well. If these explanations don't make any sense, or they don't quite match your experience, then give them a ponder. If it still doesn't make sense, set it down, practice some metta, come back to it another day. Yeah. So what is the nutriment of physical food? And the Buddha says coarse or subtle. Well, again, the mind can't eat. It can't consume, it can't digest, it can't assimilate, it can't excrete. The mind has no form, the mind has no body. But the body can do these things. And you, each one of you, except for Phil today, has a body. I can see it. Yeah. So dependent on having a body, dependent on having a form, and dependent on being attached to that form, you've only had one body for your entire life, there is the need of that body for physical food. Yeah. And because that body needs physical food, it begins to form a desire for particular foods, nourishing foods, foods that help it to grow and to thrive and to multiply. I mean, if a squirrel spends all day finding an acorn, it will eat and it'll go to sleep and it'll spend the next day looking for an acorn. But if the squirrel happens to find a pile of acorns, it begins to gather them all into its cabin, and then having its food source and not having to go look for more food, it begins to multiply. It immediately sets about trying to breed. And this is the body. When we're set, when we have food, then we start looking for other kinds of pursuits. We stop worrying about food. But when we don't have food, usually our entire mental status is trying to get food. Because without that, this body will die. So the mind is not getting the food, is not seeking the food, is not eating the food, but rather the mind is dependent on the body. And we could say the mind believes it is the body. And now, probably some of you would be like, well, that's not all. I don't always think I'm the body. Well, then go without eating. And you will find that, maybe after you've had breakfast and you're sitting here listening to a Dhamma talk, you're really not, you don't care, you're not totally associated with the body right now. You're focusing on, trying to learn something. But just give it a little while. And suddenly, when the body starts to get hungry or thirsty or hot or cold or sleepy or restless, then it's kind of hard to ignore. And this first nutriment is recognizing that some of our mental states are dependent on the food condition of the body. And it's not always out of hunger. Sometimes you get weak and despondent and start thinking about food and start dreaming about particular foods because you're hungry. But sometimes you've eaten food and you get listless and sleepy, and you don't have any aspiration to do anything, and you just kind of lay back and want to digest like a snake that swallowed an entire egg in one mouthful. These mental states are spawned because of the body eating food, right? And it doesn't matter whether it was gross food, like substantial food, or whether it was like vitamin water or something. Sometimes you have a simple vitamin water or juice that's just got a bit of sugar in it. This is a subtle food. It's not really something that'll keep you going long term, but it's got a little bit of oomph to it. And dependent on that, if you give a box of juice to a child, there will be all sorts of mental states arise that weren't there a minute before. Yeah, that child will be bouncing off the walls, and just try to contain it. Now, it's not that the mind ate the juice, but with juice as a condition, those mental states arose. So how would we use this in our practice? Well, most people eat regularly. It is possible that you could fast for a time, but only for a time. This would not really be sustainable in the long term. But if you were to try, and the monks, again, do this every day for 16, 20 hours, you would find that some mental states go quiet because they need the proximity of the body eating food. And the same with you. If any of you have fasted, you probably found that after a day or two, what before was a very loud mental state, it's dinner time, gotta eat dinner, became a very quiet mental state. Like it's almost dinner time, all right, but no, we're not gonna, no, not gonna, okay, well, I'm just not gonna think about it. Became a not mental state at all. Maybe on day three or four or five of the fast, you were shocked at how peaceful you were. But you were hungry, but you weren't thinking about food all the time. You were just kind of like, wow, the intestines make a lot of restless noise in the body. It's kind of nice when they go quiet, but it's not sustainable, but it's kind of nice when it happens. And you could just look. So the Buddha's encouragement, a practice he calls always appropriate, is moderation in eating. Eat in simple, predictable times of the day. Eat for the nourishing of the body, specifically with the purpose of nourishing the body, because once you've accomplished that, you tend to stop. And then you don't. I've eaten today. I'm good. How many of you say that? Somebody offers you something, you're like, no, I ate today. I'm good. Like, when did you eat? I had breakfast. I'm fine. It was almost a bowl of food. Yeah. I'm good. I'm good till tomorrow, at least. Nobody says this. It's just not something people say. Like, oh, yes, please, I'll have another. But you can look. Yeah. What, does sleepiness arise due to the proximity of having eaten food? Does restlessness arise based on the proximity of having had a cup of coffee? Does this arise? Does that arise? Do you get grumpy when you eat something heavy? Do you get all happy when you eat something like really delicious? You're like, oh, you gotta try something. You have waffles today. It's so great. Yeah. The mental state had food as its condition, yeah. And that if you didn't have that food, if you didn't have that experience, the mental state wouldn't be there. Maybe it would arise for a second, but then it wouldn't be able to last. It wouldn't be able to grow and persist and linger. The second nutriment is called contact, and this is sense contact, right? So say I've got a nice, juicy, crisp red apple, and you're walking by. It's, maybe I've put it on Jim's table for some reason, even though it's so busy on there. And you're walking by and you see that big juicy red apple, and you, whoa, that looks really good. What kind of apple is that? Is that what people, is that organic? Is this what people do in Massachusetts? And so you're kind of intrigued by its qualities, yeah? That it has qualities which produce a pleasant feeling. And the sense contact causes certain mind states of thinking about, oh, what kind of, oh, maybe I feel like apple right now, or so, oh, yeah, I'm not quite hungry, but wow, some apple juice, that would really hit the spot, or apple cider. What's that time of year, isn't it? Nice cup of hot apple cider. Suddenly, based on that sense contact, all sorts of mental states start to arise. Yeah. Now, suppose you're allergic to apples and you're walking by and you see that big juicy red apple, and what you see is hives and itching and pain. You would immediately throw yourself against the wall. Now you say, who let that in here? Don't you know I'm deathly allergic to apples? What if I had touched that? So all sorts of mental states arise with contact as their condition. Yeah? Now, contact doesn't last very long, but what we will find is there is a way that the mind desires and goes back to these attractive things. It looks for these attractive things. So, contact is the source of feeling, and feeling is kind of our compass for how we make decisions in the world if we're not paying attention, right? We're trying to get pleasant feeling, get away from unpleasant feeling. We're kind of so-so about neutral feeling. And this is, if we don't pay attention, this is how we lead our lives. And so we're always kind of seeking mode for this kind of food, for this kind of nutriment. And when we find it, we keep circling back to it over and over again to get the particular feelings that we want. And crazy enough, some people keep going back to the same place to get unpleasant feelings. Really like to be angry. They like to be indignant. They like to be pissed off. And so they go looking for it. They turn on the news and they just can't wait to hear about somebody who did something in some place that'll make them angry. Because again, it gives them a sense of being alive, yeah? As the nutriment for those mental states. Now, the third kind of nutriment, can we go on a bit long, but we'll just try to explain it. Manosanjetana is a really clunky, rare Pali construction, which shows up in the Abhidhamma, or the sort of the esoteric mental constituent part of the Dhamma. What does it mean? It was translated as mental intention in the sutta, but it has three parts. Mano means mind. Chetana is a mental state, or it's a state that causes things to happen. So it's usually linked to volition or activity. And san, in the middle there, it means to bring together. Yeah. So mano sanchetana is sort of the process of the mind bringing things together, or the mind starting things, or the mind doing things for a particular purpose. How is this a nutriment? Well, it's really hard to wrap our mind around it. But say I bring up a juicy, crisp red apple. The thing is the red and the juicy and the crisp, are they the same thing? Does juicy mean anything to the eye? No. Does crisp mean anything to the eye? No. Can you see crisp? No. Maybe if somebody were to break it apart and you saw a particular way that they broke it apart, you might be like, oh, it's a very crisp, crackly kind of apple. But to the eye, that it would look almost indistinguishable from a squishy apple, to be honest. Crisp matters to the body. It's about hardness and softness and pliability. Yeah. Juicy matters to the tongue. It's about the water element. You can't really see juicy. I mean, you see an apple and you see juice, but you can't see the juice in the apple, right? You can tell that the apple is dehydrated or not, maybe by the shininess. But so what is it when I say a big red juicy apple, that even though the eye sees red and the tongue sees juicy and the ear and the body can perceive crisp? Yeah. Why is it that those all go together? Manas and Chetana. Yeah. It's not we see the red apple and we think, oh, that's just juicy and crisp. It's a honey crisp apple. It's organic. It's from the farm just down the street. It's probably perfect. It'll be so satisfying at lunch. I can't wait for lunch so I can crack into that apple and I can make it into all these little slices and slather them with peanut butter. And it'll be so good. This is manosanchetana. It is the mind taking things that are independent on their own and bringing them together, sticking them together. And this is the cause for a lot of different mental states. It is a nutriment for mental states. We do this a lot. This is a huge part of our mind, because otherwise we would be having nothing but simple moment-to-moment experiences that wouldn't be really connected much. They were there to moments of connection, but then we'd immediately let that go. And we'd see the apple and be like, oh, it's bright red apple. And then we'd eat the apple and be like, oh, that's very juicy. And we cut up the apple and be like, oh, listen to that. What does that sound? It's crisp. Yeah. It's perfect. Not too ripe, just a little ripe. But we don't settle for that, do we? Another example, and this is one I tend to use, is habit energy. When we find ourselves in a particular place, does it lead to certain mind states arising? So we were talking about couches the other day, right? And what is the couch except as a landing pad for all sorts of consciousnesses? You lay down in that couch, and how long is it until you're scrolling on your phone? How long is it until you're thinking about having a snack? How long is it until your eyes are starting to get heavier? And you're starting to think, well, maybe I'll do the gardening later. It looks like it's getting cloudy out there anyway. Maybe I'll get to it another time. All of these mental states gathering and being associated with that one original activity. It's not necessarily a sense contact. There's no particular sense contact of you sinking into the couch. It's more about the location, and it's more about the habit energy. If you work at a business and they have a break time, And at break time, you go out back and you sit down at a picnic table. And some people smoke and some people have a drink. Some people have a snack. Some people scroll on their phone. All of these things are associated with the break time in that picnic table. So if it's break time, they might find themselves craving to go out to the picnic table. Why? Because it's break time. That's what we do. I'm not going to stay here at my workstation when I could be out there having slightly more fun. So they get up and they go out to the picnic table. For why? Manasanjetana. There's mind states of relaxing, of stopping to think about the work, starting to think about other things, of taking snacks, of smoking, of having a drink. Those they've associated those particular activities with that particular place in time and space. And so it's dependent on those. And if that person were to say, no, when I go out to the picnic table, I always get in arguments and I always scroll on my phone and I always have stuff that I worry about and I forget what I've been doing and I make a mess of things. So I'm not going to go out to the picnic table. I'm not going to do that to take my break. Well, then all of those mental states, which were dependent on that, suddenly have nowhere to land. Having nowhere to land, they can't grow, they can't multiply. Now they might find new homes if you're not careful. But if you don't let them, then they will cease. Yeah, all of those activities that you thought were inherent to having a job and taking a break were dependent on that. The final one is consciousness, and as we're talking about, this is a hard one to kind of extract. Yeah, but again, we've been talking about it the whole time, like seeing the food on the table, that is consciousness. Having sense contact, the different qualities. That is consciousness. The habit energy of where we land and when and how, that is consciousness. But even if we've dealt with the other nutriments, consciousness itself is arising dependent on us being alive. And that's not a condition I encourage you to cease anytime soon. I mean, because you're alive, consciousness is going to keep arising for the time being. Right? But that's not the problem, is it? The problem is how it becomes dependent on something. It latches onto something, it grows and multiplies dependent on something. So what are consciousnesses that cause this growth and multiplication? And these are any consciousnesses which deal with anything that causes the mind to linger. Yeah. And it's this is maybe harder to see, but like your body, if you have a pain in your knee, right? It is a particular moment of body consciousness when you think about how your knee feels, right? And when you think about how your knee feels, it hurts, right? So the condition for that pain is thinking about your knee. And if we frame it like that, it's kind of like, why do you keep thinking about your knee? If the suffering and the pain of being aware of the knee is dependent on you being aware of the knee, and the end of the suffering of being aware of the pain in the knee is to stop becoming aware of the pain in the knee. It couldn't possibly be that simple, could it? Do we have a choice? We have a choice when there's a pain in the knee to not focus on the pain in the knee? I would say we do, but are we willing? Even as an experiment to stop obsessing about the pain in the knee. Well, give it a try during meditation, yeah? Ask yourself, it's like, what would happen if I were to stop paying attention to the pain in the knee? Well, the knee might cease, it might blink out of existence, right? Are you okay with that? Or do you still want the knee? Do you still want feedback from the knee, even if it's unpleasant? This is the question. Could you be okay if your knee consciousness was something that arose only every now and then? Based on causes and conditions, and not because you are seeking it. Every time it did, you'd be like, oh, yeah, it still hurts. But then you'd immediately forget about it. Would that be okay to just every now and then be aware of your knee? This is a question, yeah? And this is that nutriment. When you're not okay to just leave it be, just let it arise on its own. This is a dependency on consciousness itself, a belief that consciousness has to happen. That very belief makes more consciousnesses happen. It binds them to a particular event or fuel source. Yeah. Being bound, they're like fire. They grow and they consume and they hurt. Yeah. Okay. So these are the four nutriments. And again, you asked for And let's do some meditation, yeah? So, like always, we'll do sitting and walking on the half hours. You can come and go. Some of you won't be here, but we'll post the talks again. So if you miss one of them, you can come catch it later. We'll take a lunch break at 12 Eastern time. And then we'll come back at 2 for the afternoon session. We'll get another very hard-hitting sutta, a great sutta, vivid imagery, very popular. Yeah, so something to look forward to. Okay.